Good morning. Didn't have a lot of time for correspondence with Stuart, so for those of you who are hoping to hear a lot about speed cameras, I'm afraid they don't feature that greatly in the talk. I assume the correspondence between speed cameras and the law is the fact that they take pictures of us and it's completely undeniable. There it is, we've done it, we're guilty. This is a difficult text. And I think the only way we're going to get somewhere with this morning is by sort of taking three steps back from it and looking at it as a whole, as opposed to going through it verse by verse and looking at what each verse tells us. Obviously, we will be looking at specific sections of it, but it's important, I think, that we get the meaning and the flow of the passage as a complete unit. I don't know how many of you have ever had to give a difficult message to someone. And sometimes when you're trying to give a difficult message to someone, no matter how direct, tactful, clever you think you're being, it just doesn't seem to hit the point. When I left London, I left behind a group of sort of blokey friends, and we'd all become Christians from not being Christians and very holy, and so we were a sort of support group, but we were very, very close. And one of our friends, who was sat in a pub one night discussing a particular friend of ours who had a problem with finding a female companion in Christ because he reeked of BO. So this friend of mine said, don't worry, I'll deal with it, I'll settle it, I'll take him aside, we'll deal with the issue. And I should have known at that point not to trust Nick, who now manages oil rigs and crews in the Caspian Sea. I should have realised he isn't really prepared for and equipped for this type of ministry. And a couple of days later, this particular friend of ours with the problem said something very strange happened recently. He said somebody posted a can of deodorant through my front door. And he said, goodness knows what that was about. It must be some sort of free sample or something. But there was no message with it. It's just really odd what people would do, isn't it? And you see that often it can be quite difficult to get a message across to people because the place where they're at is not a particularly good situation for hearing what's being said to them. Consider the Jews, the Jewish nation. First of all, if you confront somebody with who they are or what they are, and it's negative, they don't want to hear it. Secondly, they're basing the whole of their self-worth on a particular status. That's another layer through which you have to penetrate to get a message across. Thirdly, you're confronting them with something which not only is politically sensitive or abhorrent to them, but you're actually having to tell them that they need to change fundamentally the way they think, the way they are, the way they behave, and the whole aura around which they derive any self-worth. That is a difficult message to get home. And this is the context of this particular passage. And as I say, speed cameras don't feature greatly in what we have to say. But if we could have the first slide, what we're going to try and do is go through the passage, picking out some of the relevant points from this background. Now, at first reading, this portion of Paul's letter can appear almost to be a digression within the thematic sort of continuity of the letter. Paul appears to sort of go off on one. You know how it is sometimes when you ask somebody a particular question and suddenly you find you're in the presence of an individual who has got a passion for the thing you've asked about and you're getting a lot more information, possibly a bit like Stuart and speed cameras. I mean, I don't know where that was coming from. But Paul appears to sort of stray off into detail on the issue of Jewish law when possibly a more succinct coverage of the topic would have been, you know, would have been appropriate. But What makes this passage difficult in some respects is Paul's sudden herring off on this particular topic in the context of what the letter says. But the issue is really that Paul had to ensure that his readers were in absolutely no doubt as to a Christian believer, as somebody who has faith in God, their position before God's law. And this is of critical significance to the community to which Paul was writing, and it's of critical significance to us today. And unsurprisingly, the issues which Paul's analysis unearths are important for us, because we often feel that God should let us into a relationship with him. God should accept us individuals because I'm worth it. Paul's chief concern was to emphasize that God exists in perfection. God exists in holiness. But he loves us and seeks to draw us to himself. But that this introduction to God himself is by a route which God alone has secured. Now, this was as hard for the community in Rome to understand in Paul's day as it often is for us to hear. The issue of self-worth, self-justification, and real humility before God. We're going to look at the passage dealing with law under these headings. But the first thing we need to think about, if we could have the next slide, is the passage in the context of the epistle. As I said earlier, Paul's readers really needed convincing. Subtlety and tact were not going to be appropriate here. He needed a bombshell to move them from where they were. Now, the Jewish community at Rome, in Rome, were possibly at a point we can all arrive at. We want to derive comfort. We want to derive self-worth. We want to derive part of our identity from the position we're in, from the world we live in. We want to enjoy bits and pieces that God's church can offer us, but stay where we are. What Paul is saying, and what Paul proved by his life, is that this is not where he was coming from. He'd moved totally out of the world he'd previously inhabited into a completely different place where his self-worth and everything he valued was totally derived from his faith. Now, for the Jewish community, the means to God, the way we got to God, the law, had actually become an end in itself. If you like, observance of the law for the Jewish nation had become a key performance indicator. The Jewish people were pointing to a place that God no longer inhabited. It was like they were sitting underneath a signpost that pointing to God, but they remained under that signpost. And in swapping the means for the end, they were exchanging God's invitation and God's imperatives for a man-centered, an individual, human-centered experience. And this is the reason for Paul's focus on the law and the issues it addresses in this passage have been issues for the church throughout church history. Can we have the next slide, please? Now, I don't want to get too technical, but it will greatly help our understanding of this passage if we consider Paul's comments in the context of Israel's unique position in global history. God had concluded a covenant or a treaty with Israel as a nation. And the significance of this treaty spans most of the Old and New Testaments, and actually, for those with faith in Jesus, that covenant extends to today, or if you're within the Hasidic Jewish community, that covenant is still very, very important to you. Now, at the point the law is given by God in Exodus 19, God both proclaimed Israel's distinctiveness as a nation and explained that Israel actually had a global mission to fulfill. But at the point that the law is delivered to Israel, we are told that Israel occupied a separate situation, but was also a separate possession for God. As we see, this is demonstrated in Exodus 19. And the law was to be a sort of facilitator for enabling Israel to fulfill their global destiny. We see Israel are identified as God's possession. They're identified as a kingdom of priests. And they're identified as a holy nation. And God tells the people, the whole earth is mine. Israel were to reach out to the whole earth. They had a mission to fulfill. And the law was central to this. The law was the framework within which God's empowering, God's gifts were to be received by the Jewish nation. So the Jewish nation held a great store in this law that we're looking at, and which features again and again and again in the text that was read to us. I didn't count how many times the word law was used, but you'll have remembered it just came up many, many times. So we could have the next slide. From Exodus 20, we can see that God had already acted to place Israel in a privileged position. Observance of the Jewish law wasn't a condition of God doing this. It had already happened. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I've done that. Thou shalt not. So the commandments start after God's act had happened. So the law wasn't a condition of God giving Israel its special status, but it was the terms under which that status was to continue. The saving act of God had actually preceded the law giving. So how could the law actually give Israel its status? But that had been turned round over the course of history, not because the Jewish people are any different to the rest of us, but because of human nature. God says, if you're to maintain the position of privilege and benefit fully, this is how you should behave. If you're going to fulfill the mission that I've entrusted to you, this is how you should do it. So we see that the covenant came after God had acted in history, but the covenant came before the law was actually given. So that the law is a framework for living as God's people, which God intends Israel to carry out, where God intends the people of Israel to carry his message to the rest of the world. As I said before, God tells Israel in Exodus 19, the whole world is mine. These are the people. These are the people Israel is to reach. Now, in Exodus 19, Israel was meant to minister, or rather to be the channel of God's ministry to the rest of the world. Now, the covenant history at the time of Israel began with Abraham. It then moved to Israel, the laws given. But where was it to go from Israel subsequently? And that's really the issue Paul's addressing. in the passage we read today. Now, hopefully, by looking, kind of the next slide, this slide isn't as daunting, hopefully, as it first appears. But it is important because it helps us to get this passage into some sort of context. Because the Torah, the law that Paul's talking about, has distinct parts. The Torah is set within distinct units. The Torah itself that Paul talks about is the complete covenant obligation. First of all, we have the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are a directional code wrapped around the proclamation as to why and how the code is to be applied. And I set out on the slide the distinction, the important distinctions between the Ten Commandments, the Hagenda, but this is directional, and I think the critical distinctions are that it's directional and it's given directly to the people. There was no intermediary between God and the people. Whereas the Levitical laws, the code, the halacha, are in the form of rules for conduct. And there was an intermediary in this case. In the Levitical code, we see that they're described as judgments. They are prescriptive, and there are fines and there are punishments for not keeping them. They're not they're focusing down, they're a drilling down of the Ten Commandments, which are more directional, as I say, and principles for how to live a life in front of God. The Ten Commandments are really an exposition of religious truth, whereas the Levitical code are rules for conduct. So that's how the Torah, that's how the law looks. And if we can understand this distinction, I think it helps us a lot in getting behind and underneath and drilling down into the passage that we've got in front of us today. But another really critical point is that the law, the Torah, was actually founded in history. The Torah was embedded in narrative of historical events which are religiously significant. The Jewish nation could point to a time when the law was given from God. They could actually recite the words that God had given. It's not like an ethical code which is sort of developed over time. It would be nice if, you know, or a sort of philosophical framework or paradigm where we decide how people should relate to each other. The Jewish nation could say, God gave us this. He gave us this on this particular date, and these are the very words that God used, and this is how we should live our life. They could point to a point where God said, if you belong to me, this is what you should look like. So if we move on to the next slide. Now, a significant event in the Old Testament are the prophecies which announce that God's going to act in a new way. Israel had adopted the law and were happy to take the status that came with the law, but they'd forgotten, or they'd chosen to ignore, the mission that had been committed to them. Israel had actually lost the truth that all privilege is from God, and that outside of the covenant, outside of this agreement with God, the privilege will wither and die. And Jeremiah and other prophets, as I've shown in this particular passage, are looking forward to a time when righteousness, by which we mean when right standing before God, springs from a heart relationship with God. And this is the arrival of God's kingdom with Jesus. The very last part of Jeremiah 31:31. I will set my law, my Torah, with them and write it on their hearts. So this is law as a component of the covenant, but that covenant is moving forward. The way the law is communicated is going to change. So, if we can have the next slide. I don't know how many of you have And before I sort of got around to doing this, I must admit I hadn't given it much thought, how significant it was that both John and Jesus lay down markers from the very inception of Jesus' ministry, of his relationship to the law. The fact that Jesus was baptized, the baptism of Jesus was actually outside of the accepted Levitical rite of purification. So it indicates the eclipsing of the Levitical code, and it also indicates the incompatibility of the Levitical code with God's real truth and real direction. Now, the Levitical code wasn't devalued, but its relevance in the face of Jesus, the relevance of the Levitical code in the face of its author, in the face of its author's presence, in the face of its author's ministry, and in the face, more importantly, of its author's empowering, was superseded. And then moving on, the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is a clear parallel to the giving of the law. Jesus refers, almost, he draws the parallel, it was said. He draws the parallel himself. There's a clear linkage of the Ten Commandments to the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount announced how men and women are to live within the protection and empowerment of God's kingdom as Jesus was bringing it. So in the same way as for the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount was given within the wrapper of God's proclamation of liberation and statehood. The Sermon on the Mount announces the arrival of God's kingdom in Jesus. Now, the Gospels are completely replete with examples of Jesus' exasperating the authorities with breaches of the Levitical code. There are dozens and dozens of them, if you begin to think through. Lots of examples in which Jesus breaks the Levitical code in order to bring the kingdom of God to the lepers, to the outcasts, and to people that are marginalized. Jesus, the actual author of the Levitical code, demonstrates how to live the proclamation, the directional content of the Torah law through direct communion with his Father. So Jesus is living out the Torah, but not by looking at a set of rules in a book. He's doing it with direct communication with God the Father. The rule book wasn't relevant anymore. The trouble is that we as people, the Jewish nation, the church in Rome, would prefer the rule book to God actually holding up a mirror to us, holding up a mirror to our hearts, holding up a mirror to our motivations, and being made aware of our desperate individual moral bankruptcy in the light of God's perfection. That is not an easy message for us to hear. Can we have the next slide, please? Now, the message as to the function and the purpose of the law was carried into the early church. The point Paul's seeking to bring out to the hearers or to the readers of this letter is that inclusion of individuals within the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ by acceptance of the work that Jesus has done on the cross in our place is the ultimate realization of the covenant. Do you remember on the covenant we had Abraham, we had Israel, and then we had the question mark. The question mark is answered by the death, resurrection, and inclusion of us in the work of Jesus. This is how we enter God's kingdom. And the state of each one of us is that we're clothed in the righteousness of God himself, in full satisfaction of the law. The law is satisfied as a consequence of what Jesus has done for us. And this is through the full personal knowledge of Jesus in our hearts, day to day. We come under Jesus' influence, and he directs our moral understanding. So there's two points to this. Our status is confirmed as acceptable to God through the death of Jesus. Our behaviour is drawn into conformity with God's will. And I've drawn on other examples from Paul's writing. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 6. God has qualified us to dispense his new covenant, a covenant expressed not in a written document, but a spiritual bond. And in verse 14, Paul talks about how the new covenant has been introduced and the old covenant has ended. And the penultimate line, we're transfigured into his likeness. Now, to the extent we allow Jesus to participate and direct us in our decision-making, Jesus himself sets the quality and direction of our behaviour. This is the distinction between the two covenants, which is drawn time after time by Paul. And the reason why Paul can talk about freedom from the law, later on in Romans, Christ is the end of law. You're not under law, you're under grace. Paul can talk about the end of the law, the end of Torah, but that doesn't mean that we're just free to do what we like. It doesn't mean that there is no regulation over our behaviour. It doesn't mean that we're not responsible to God for our behaviour. What it means is that we expect our moral behaviour to be in conformity with the law, but that Jesus is helping us do that. Jesus is leading us to that. Jesus is empowering us to do that. If we think we've had a personal experience of Jesus, but our behaviour hasn't changed, then there's something wrong. A relationship with Jesus Christ will change our behaviour. We will be different if we spend time with him. God's Holy Spirit will empower us and move us towards conformity with his holy law, the way we should live. Our status has been determined. The death of Jesus on the cross means the law, the requirements of the law are satisfied. But day on day, our personal relationship with Jesus will move us to be the type of people he wants us to be. And so could we have the last slide? So what? The most difficult bit of any sermon. Well, the passage this morning makes clear the bankruptcy of men and women in the face of God's perfection. What Paul is trying to do in this section of the letter is make clear to the community in Rome the futility of our trying to reach to God's standards by our own efforts. Paul's message of alienation from the perfection of God extends to every single one of us. No attempt by any person to reach God can ever succeed. Which is why I was talking about the fact that in the Roman church, what was happening was that they were trying to make their own lives more comfortable by just dipping into what suited them from the Christian church. And how many of us are the same today? What we derive from our faith doesn't catapult us into a transformed life. It just makes our secular life a bit more enjoyable or a bit more comfortable. Intellectually, it just helps us to feel more grounded or secure. I'm as guilty, I'm as guilty of that as anyone. But what Jesus wants for us is to be transformed and challenged and to really derive more self-worth and empowerment outside of the law, but through the relationship with him. Now, Paul can speak so comprehensively on this subject because he knew the law pretty well. But the interesting thing is that despite Paul's status and knowledge of the law as being one of the top Pharisees of his day, it actually took a confrontation with Jesus on the Damascus Road to catapult him out of where he was into where the truth is. Paul would be the equivalent of a top theologian in a British university or any university anywhere in the world who understood the derivation of the Bible. He could speak Hebrew, Greek, could read all the texts, had a full philosophical grasp of everything there is to know about Christianity, but had never met the person of Jesus. God effectively humiliated him by making him blind, led by the hand into Damascus. Some poor guy who was terrified of Paul has to go along, pray over him, open his eyes. That needs to happen in order for us to move out of an understanding of the concept of the law into the living reality of the law being worked out in our hearts in the new covenant. So I think personally what I asked for this morning and what this passage has drawn me to is sensitivity to be made ever conscious of the gulf between myself and God's perfection and of the way we get to understand Jesus more intimately and our passport into God's presence, which is simply the work of his Son. And that is where Paul was needing to get the Roman church to. And this is and this part of the letter is really preparation for that. He had to undermine their confidence in their own self-worth and everything they'd achieved, everything in their heritage which they held dear, everything on which they based their confidence. If it's outside of the work of Christ in the cross, then frankly, we need to get to the same place. Okay, thank you.